This is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. So good to be with you. Stephen Tobolowsky may well be among your very favorite actors, but you may not necessarily associate his name with his face. Maybe that's because he becomes his characters, which is the essence of a great character actor. He was the weatherman in the movie Groundhog Day. He's been in Glee, The Goldbergs. He is Dr. Shulman of Shulman & Associates on the Mindy Project. And currently, you may think of him as Jack Barker on Silicon Valley. Stephen is also an author, and he joins us now to talk about his new book, My Adventures with God. Stephen Tobolowsky, welcome.
Good morning, Lois. Good morning.
Oh, so good to have you here. Your book opens with a prologue titled, A Prayer for Hannah Mulder. Why did you pray for someone whom you never met?
I have no idea, but I think we all do in a way. My wife and I were having lunch at a restaurant. We've been taking Hebrew for years, and we cannot absorb it. Our brains are too stiff and crusty. It takes a plastic brain to get Hebrew. But a woman was walking to her table, and she sees us and says, are you two Jewish? And I said, well, yeah. And she said, well, I know this woman, Hannah Mulder. She's very ill. Is there a prayer you can say for the critically ill? And I said, well, yeah, there are these early morning services on Monday and Thursday. If you go into those services, you can say that prayer. And she says, well, do you go to those services? And I go, well, yeah. I mean, when I'm not working, and by working, I meant sleeping. And I said, wait. Well, she said, well, are you going to go tomorrow? I go, tomorrow? And she said, well, tomorrow is Thursday. Are you going to go to one of those services? And I said, sure. And so the next morning, and I got up early. The services start at 7:30. And I got up at the appropriate time, and I prayed for Hannah Mulder. And the strangest thing happened. The rest of the service, I was thinking, who is this person I just prayed for? And did my prayer matter? And is she getting better? Or is she already passed on? I had no idea. But the more curious thing was, the next Monday, I woke up and I thought, I got to go back and pray for Hannah Mulder. It was like pulling the spiritual rug out from under someone. And now it's been years. And still, at that moment of the service, I feel compelled to stand and say Hannah Mulder's name. I think the idea of that story is the invisible that connects us all in a way. When we feel we can reach out and grab someone, we tend to try to do that.
What do you find most difficult in writing or telling a story about God?
Oh, well, ouch. I think the most difficult thing about writing a story about God is that God is different for different people and at different times in your life. Certainly the God I knew when I was a little boy going to Sunday school, learning all those Bible stories, is different from the God I saw in my girlfriend's eyes in my 20s, and very different from the God I found when I came back to Judaism with my wife, Anne, and found the beauty and depth of this religion that I never knew as a child. And also, unfortunately, when we are in crisis, when either our lives or someone who we love's life is in jeopardy, we find a different face of God at those times too. So that's the difficult part. I think in the Torah, in the Old Testament, now out there, please Google this. I do not vouch for this fact, but I believe a Torah scholar would know there's something like 41 different names used to refer to God in the Torah. So the question is, which name of God resonates for you at that particular time? That's what's so difficult. When you write a story that includes God, you are not dealing with algebra. You are dealing with you're dealing with algebra too. You're dealing with an equation with more than one unknown.
The book is divided into sections, and I was hoping you could explain how the arc of your life follows the same path as the Torah.
Oh, you just touched on my article of desperation. When Simon and Schuster asked me to, they said, can you write these stories that are humorous but have a spiritual bent to them? I said, well, sure, not a problem. I had no idea what I was going to write. So I'm sitting home and I think of this idea that turned out to be inspiring, not inspired, but inspiring in that I thought my life and everyone's life I know seems to fall into the template of the first five books of Moses. Like we all have a Genesis. These are usually the first stories we tell on first dates with the first glass of Chardonnay. Who we are, where we come from, what our aspirations are. Then we all go into slavery. Some of us through first loves or terrible first jobs, unfortunate friends lose themselves in drugs and alcohol, and some people just stay in graduate school forever. And then, like in the Bible, you break free of slavery, but you find you're still lost in the desert. Then there's the Leviticus moment in the middle of our life. This is when I got married. This is when I had children. This is when I returned to Judaism. And then, like in the book of Numbers, we're shaped by mortality. We lose loved ones unexpectedly. We lose the dear ones in our life, and we're reshaped and reformed. And if we're lucky, we get to Deuteronomy, where we tell our stories to others to see what this whole journey was about anyway. So this turned out to be the arbitrary kind of areas I was going to write my true stories in. And it turned out to be inspiring because as I was writing the stories, it seemed to be more and more of a true perception about the way people live.
But you do it without sounding presumptuous. I mean, a lot of people, if they'd say, okay, my life has followed the path of the Torah, you know, we would say, this is a Michigana and an arrogant one at that. But
well, I'm lucky. You see, when I started writing these stories, I learned what a moron I've been in my life. At almost every turn, I find amusement in how many bad decisions I've made. And at every turn, I get even more surprised at how I was rescued by some kind of love. And dare I say, something invisible that I cannot describe, that I could not put my finger on, that is a mystery that is beyond me. And as I wrote this book, I felt more and more in touch with how we are all shaped by the invisible. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to call it the divine. Other people could call it whatever they want. But that's why I have two pairs of pants in my closet with a size 32 waist. Still, I always hope and I always believe.
Well, there are so many wonderful stories within stories that make up your book. And one I found especially funny involves your parents' adaptation of a Jewish Christmas celebration. Like your parents, my parents let us believe in Santa Claus, but stopped short of the tree. You know, it was okay to go trim the neighbor's trees, to go look at Marshall Field store windows in Chicago with the gorgeous trees, but you didn't. If you were Jewish, you didn't have a tree. But your mother had a hilarious solution as to where to leave the presents.
Well, it wasn't hilarious to us at the time.
But it is
only hilarious.
Tell the story.
What is it? Time plus tragedy equals comedy.
Okay.
My mother said because we were Jewish, we could not have a Christmas tree. Don't know why. It's kind of a pagan symbol. But we couldn't have a Christmas tree, but we would be able, Santa would bring our presents under the dining room table. So every Christmas morning, we woke up and ran to the dining room, forced our way through the chairs, looking for presents that had our name written on them, banging our head on the hard mahogany. And I remember I asked Mom, I said, Mom, I don't get why Santa, why does he put the presents under the table? I mean, it's a lot of work for Santa. And Mom said, sweetheart, Santa doesn't mind doing the work. He just doesn't want you to feel you're different from other children.
See?
I said, different? Nobody gets their presents under a dining room table. We're totally different. You know, and when people get their presents under the tree, the presents aren't under the tree. They're around the tree. And my mother just did what most people do when they use a conspiracy theory for their basis of reality. She passed the blame on up to a higher authority. She said, "Steppy Doors, I don't know, sweetheart. I wrote a letter to Santa.
See?
I told him we were Jewish, and he said he was fine putting the presents under the dining room table. I don't know why he said that. You'll just have to talk to Santa."
It's all part of assimilation. It's just part of the process. But well, that was so hilarious.
Where did you grow up?
Chicago.
Oh, well, there are Jews in Chicago.
But there were Jews in Dallas, too?
Well, we were in Oak Cliff, and there were three Jewish families. There were, now this is not an exaggeration, there were more members of the American Nazi Party in Oak Cliff than there were Jews.
Oh,
in fact, when I was playing basketball, John Rutledge, who was a guard on our team, we're in sixth grade, so we're 12. His mom invites us over for pimento cheese sandwiches and Pepsi after one of our many losses. And we walk into John's house, and there in the dining room is a bust of Adolf Hitler.
Oh, my God.
With two German flags on each side. And on a coffee table in front of the fireplace are Stormtrooper magazines laid out like Highlights magazines in a pediatrician's office. And I found something kind of shocking yet refreshing, that John and his family didn't feel the need to tidy up after a Bund rally. They were...
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we had very different upbringings, although if that weren't true, you know, it could give Mel Brooks a run for his money with Springtime for Hitler.
I do have a footnote on the Santa Claus and the dining room table story. I told that story in particular at a conference over in California, and one of the women came up after me, and she was laughing and tears and everything. And she said it was her past, too. She grew up, I think, in your neck of the woods. She grew up in Chicago way, and she said that her family was not allowed to have a Christmas tree either, but they put the presents under a giant stuffed giraffe. Now that is one for the record books.
Maybe invoking Noah's Ark. Who knew? Who knows?
Maybe. It's in the book of Genesis. It sounds good.
Well, you write lovingly of family throughout the book. I especially like how you put your mother in the company of Plato and Epicurus.
We did not have philosophers in Oak Cliff.
My mother
was our philosopher, and she used to say the curious things at curious times, like what goes up what must come down, penny saved is a penny earned. Sometimes she would make up her own philosophical phrases. I remember being a child watching television, and Mom was carrying a big load of laundry, and she stopped in front of me and said, "We should all be cats." And then she walked on. And I had no idea what she meant, that either we should be cats because cats like to sleep on clean laundry, or we should all be cats because cats don't have to do laundry in the first place. But she was my oracle at Delphi. I guess one of Mom's favorite quotations was something she ascribed to Ben Franklin. And it was whenever my heart was broken by a girl, which happened often. But my mom would sit with me in the bedroom and hold my hand lovingly and say, "Sweetheart, I know it hurts. Just remember what Ben Franklin said, that all women are the same in the dark with a basket over their heads." And I was like, "What?"
Did.
And the problem was, Mom said this all the time at family gatherings, at graduations. And finally, when I'm 50 years old, I decide the Ben Franklin quote has to end. And I force Mom into the kitchen. I said, Mom, no more with the Ben Franklin. We know what you meant, but Ben Franklin didn't mean that." And she said, "What are you talking about, Stephen?" "Mom, Ben Franklin was trying to say that a man could have a fine relationship with a woman even in the dark with a basket over her head." And Mom was like, "Uh-uh." And then finally, she got it. And she goes, "Oh, no! Stephen, no! Why would he say something like that? I said, I don't know, Mom. I thought
he meant... It was the lightning.
I thought he meant there were other fish in the sea, and you can't let your heart be broken by one person. I know, Mom, we all knew that, but that isn't what he was saying. But it's okay. We love you, and let's just drop it. Let's just drop it. That was one of her favorite quotes of all time.
What a philosopher.
I would say.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor and author Stephen Tobolowsky. His new memoir is My Adventures with God. We'll be back after a short break on WABE Atlanta. This is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes here with you and actor Stephen Tobolowsky talking about his new memoir, My Adventures with God. The chapters on your college years reveal a talent you had beyond acting, and this story leads you to touch upon a Talmudic explanation of the soul.
Right. There are, as I recall, five different chambers of the soul, one of which is innocence, another is observing while being unobserved, and a couple of the chambers were mysteries, and I found out that my love for my girlfriend Beth was evolving in the same Talmudic path of the soul. Our love was innocent. Even though it was the age of free love, we didn't. I learned all my lessons from the Cracker Jack box that anything that was free is probably not worth anything. We observed. We were in the theater department together, my girlfriend Beth and I. We observed plays. We watched life together. And the other two chambers of the soul were a mystery, and I felt like as our love moved through different pathways, we would understand what those two chambers were. But I never found that out, and I don't know if anyone ever did. I think it's interesting that in the Talmud, it was not a question about if there was a soul, but that there was a soul, and it was a physical organ, just like a kidney or a heart or a brain. I think more than the accuracy of science, because the Talmud was formulated before there was anything called science, it was interesting that it point out that man, from the very beginning of our consciousness, has tried to figure things out both through what is seen and what is unseen. Just like quantum physicists are now with the beginning of the solar system, the beginning of the universe. We rely so much on what we know from the Hadron Collider, from particle physics, but also we are believing that there is definitely something out there we don't know that's going to give us answers to questions. And I don't see how that's any different than faith.
Mm. When asked by a reporter to describe your Judaism, you gave an existential answer. You said it's not something you do, but something you are. And this begins the story of how you began to attend synagogue regularly.
Yeah, it was unusual. I was doing a TV show in Los Angeles, cast a big part. It was right after Groundhog Day. So I thought, oh man, this is going to be fabulous. So I was a regular on a sitcom. And Barry Camp, a wonderful writer and producer, was saying, we're going to work on Rosh Hashanah, one of the Jewish high holy days of the year. He said, is there any problem with that? And Richard Kind, who, if you know Richard's work, he's just hilarious. Richard says, like, well, we only got two Jews in this cast. That's me and Tobolowsky. We're the best Jews in the world. We don't believe in anything. And everybody laughed, and I laughed. But something inside hurt, and I realized what hurt was. It was true that my entire life, I went to religious school as a child, but the last 20 years I hadn't stepped inside of a synagogue. I was a Jew, and I was respectful of Judaism, but in name alone. I did not defend it. I did not walk the walk. And that night I couldn't sleep. And I woke up the next morning, and I remember I had worked with Larry Miller, great writer and comedian, and he mentioned a synagogue he went to on Moore Park Street. I thought, I got to find that place. So I drive early in the morning, and there's this old man sweeping in front of the synagogue. And I stop and say, excuse me, this is a synagogue. He goes, yeah, yeah, a synagogue. I said, I need a ticket for Rosh Hashanah. He goes, there are no tickets. I said, no, 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 you don't understand. I just need one. He says, I'm sorry, but there are no tickets. I said, I will stand up. I don't need to sit down. You don't understand. I need to come this year. I need to come. He says, I would like to help you, but I can't. I said, do you know when the head guy comes here, maybe I could talk to him? He says, well, I am the rabbi in charge. I'm also in charge of sweeping, but you may not like what we do here. Maybe you should come to services tonight and see if you like what we do. I said, okay, I'll come to services tonight. And I call up Annie, my wife, and said, I just been schnunkered by an old rabbi to come to Sabbath services tonight. And I told Barry Kemp, I said, I'm sorry, I am going to get a ticket for Rosh Hashanah. You'll have to work around me. And that night I went to services, and there were about 20 people there. And the old rabbi came out, and they started the service, and he could tell that I didn't know what we were doing. And he told everyone, stop, stop, stop. And without looking at me, he says, now is not the time to look at our prayer books or to look at, now is the time to sing and join us all. I didn't know the song. I didn't know. Everybody begins singing again. I put the prayer book aside and just stare into space, trying to look reverent. The rabbi stops again. Stop, stop, stop. He says, you know, there are many reasons why people come to a synagogue. Maybe for some of us, it's been a long time since we've stepped in this place. We don't know our Hebrew anymore. We don't know what we're doing. But guess what? I know Hebrew very well, and I will do the Hebrew. I don't care if you just do la-la-las. I just want you to be happy. Be happy that you're here. And he had me with the la-la-las. I went back to synagogue for the next 10 years, Saturdays and Fridays, and began learning again.
Oh, goodness. We have to continue this conversation because among the many marvelous stories, one that I don't think I'll ever forget is your depiction of Abe. That's in a chapter called A Good Day in Auschwitz, which if you can imagine joy and humor and finding a reason for living, it's in this chapter. But I guess we'll have to touch upon that when we have more time.
We'll touch upon it for part two. But that is, I think the stories about Abe are the most important to me in the book, because in a way, Abe gave me his story, and he gave me the pages and said, tell my story, please. And I did. And that's why it's important to me. It's almost why the book didn't get published, because Simon & Schuster, in one of the iterations before they published the book, got his number wrong that was on his arm at Auschwitz. And they reprinted it and put the wrong number. I said, you don't understand. That was his name. I have his story. You can't do that. We're not publishing the book if you don't publish his name. You have to get that number right. I don't stop the presses. If you can't change it, we're not doing the book. And I'd never been so mad, and Anne was saying, like, she thought a vein was going to pop. But I realized I was in charge of the story, and Simon & Schuster gladly changed it. Thank goodness.
Stephen Tobolowsky, it has been a joy getting to know you through your writing, and I thank you so very much for joining us. You say that comedy reveals truth. You reveal a lot.